and you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Monday, March 17th, 2025. I'm your host, Rachel Fields.
And I'm your host, Sam Swartz. In tonight's news,
Wisconsin voters are slated to consider yet another constitutional amendment on April 1st.
Union leaders are pressuring the UW Systems Board of Regents to discuss campus working conditions.
An incumbent alder affirms his commitment to community engagement.
Plus, in the second half, we'll share the local government's calendar for the week ahead, celebrate St. Paddy's Day with a story of international solidarity, taste test some more shots, and review two features.
All these and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for some news from around the world.
This is the BBC News with Fiona MacDonald. Canada's new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, has said his country must reduce its reliance on the United States and would instead turn towards what he described as its reliable European allies. On his first trip abroad since taking office, Mr. Carney chose to visit France and the UK instead of the US, as would normally be the case. At a news conference in London, Mr. Carney said he had achieved a great deal during his meetings. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, was there.
But he wanted to convey a very strong impression that, first of all, these alliances were very, very strong and getting stronger, that they had very detailed discussions on strengthening security, including when it came to Ukraine, and on issues like critical minerals, artificial intelligence. He said that a trade deal, a free trade deal with Britain, wasn't the priority on this visit. So you got a sense that it was the broader sort of economic and strategic partnerships.
A new global economic forecast has predicted that the trade wars unleashed by Donald Trump will hit growth and raise inflation around the world. The OECD's chief economist told the BBC the organisation was cutting growth forecasts for almost all major economies. M23 rebels say they will no longer participate in planned peace talks with the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo in Angola on Tuesday. In a statement, the group accused unspecified international institutions of undermining the peace efforts. Andrew Ochieng reports.
Earlier on Monday, M23 had said it had sent a delegation of five people to Luanda, Angola's capital, for the peace talks. Hours later, the group said it would no longer participate in the negotiations. The problem, it says, are sanctions that are being imposed on its members, including new ones that the European Union announced on Monday. The M23 claims the sanctions undermine direct dialogue and make any progress impossible. The DRC has said it will still attend the talks. M23 rebels have intensified their offensive since December, capturing large parts of eastern Congo.
The European Union and its partners have pledged $6.2 billion in aid to Syria following the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad last December. It announced the sum at a donor conference in Brussels, the first attended by Syrian authorities. The EU Commissioner for the Mediterranean, Dubravka Šuica, said she hoped the funds would help Syria move towards a more prosperous future.
I think this is good for the recovery, for the early recovery of Syria. And I also hope that Syrian authorities, who were represented by their Minister of Foreign Affairs, can be satisfied. And this money could and should be used for their early recovery and for the benefit of all Syrian citizens.
That was Dubravka Šuica. You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC in London. The British Foreign Secretary David Lammy has for the first time stated that Israel has breached international law by stopping humanitarian aid from entering Gaza since the beginning of March. Answering a question in Parliament, Mr. Lammy said Israel must defend its own security, but he said it had been 15 days since aid got into Gaza, and the UK government found that alarming. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cut aid and electricity supplies after Hamas refused to extend the first phase of the Gaza ceasefire. Venezuela has accused the United States of denying basic legal rights to more than 200 alleged gang members deported to El Salvador over the weekend. Our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, has the details.
The president of the National Assembly, Jorge Rodriguez, said the Venezuelan nationals had been denied due process. Mr. Rodriguez, who is one of President Maduro's closest allies, said there was no evidence that they were gang members or that they had committed any crime in the U.S. He said the Venezuelan government will do everything in its power to repatriate them. They've been sent to a notorious prison in El Salvador, where they will be kept initially for a year. The U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, said he's willing to take them back if they can prove they're not linked to the Tren de Aragua gang.
President Trump says his administration will make public around 80,000 pages of files related to the assassination in 1963 of President John F. Kennedy on Tuesday. The president made the announcement during a visit to an art centre named after President Kennedy. He recently made himself the centre's new chairman. President Trump has announced that he's ending Secret Service protection for Hunter Biden, the son of the former President Joe Biden. In a social media post, Mr. Trump said he was also ending protection for the former president's daughter. BBC News.
The time now is 6:06, and this is Sam Swartz and Rachel Fields with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz is slated to visit Eau Claire tomorrow as part of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's People v. Musk campaign, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Walz is expected to speak in support of liberal state Supreme Court candidate Susan Crawford, exactly 2 weeks before the election on April 1st. The event will be held in Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, which is currently represented by Republican Derek Van Orden. Van Orden recently announced that his next town hall meetings would be held virtually, citing disruptive agitators. Walz's visit will likely highlight Republican reluctance to attend in-person meetings, as well as the large amount of spending by outside groups in the Supreme Court race.
Well, hey, speaking of the Supreme Court, today the state Supreme Court heard oral arguments on Friday for a case that would determine whether corrections workers can sue the Wisconsin Department of Corrections as a class, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. The proposed class is a group of around 5,000 workers who are suing to be paid for tasks before and after their official shift time, like going through security screenings and putting on equipment. The state argues that the class is too different, with some employees able to do their tasks outside their shift in a trivial amount of time.
The Wisconsin Technical College System Board voted last week to increase their tuition next year, reports the Capital Times. Wisconsin Technical Colleges, which includes Madison College, will increase their tuition fees by approximately 2%, or around a $50 increase for a full-time student. The modest increase is expected to add around $4 million of revenue for the entire system. In addition to the tuition increase, the technical college system is seeking more funding from the state in this year's round of budget negotiations. Governor Evers' biennial budget proposal includes a request for an additional $45 million to go to the system.
The state's Department of Military Affairs will not be getting a noise mitigation grant from the United States Department of Defense, reports the Capital Times. The state applied for an $18 million grant to offset the noise pollution from F-35 jets at the Dane County Airport. The money would have allowed 162 homes near the airport to install new insulation, windows, and HVAC systems to deal with the noise. With the grant falling through, it is unclear where else homeowners in the area might turn. The Department of Military Affairs had previously signaled that they may dip into other funds to help the affected residents, but it is unclear if those plans are still in consideration.
The parents of two young boys who drowned in a retention pond last year are suing the city and school district of Sun Prairie, as well as the bus company that operated the bus that dropped them off, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The two boys died when they fell through the ice at a city-owned retention pond near their bus stop. The lawsuit alleges that the city, school, and bus operator knew that the site was dangerous, but did not take reasonable measures to ensure the safety of the children. For its part, the city of Sun Prairie says it was in compliance with local ordinances and that it follows state guidelines on pond design. The city installed a chain-link fence around the pond 2 weeks after the boys drowned.
The city of Madison issued 8 notices for excessive salting over this winter, an increase over the 3 notices issued last year. reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The continued use of salt has resulted in slowly increasing levels of chloride in the local lakes, which can eventually become toxic to aquatic life. The city's own use of salt is down slightly from last year by about 3%. Those were today's headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Wisconsin voters are slated to consider a referendum this spring that would codify voter ID requirements in the state's constitution. The amendment has its supporters and its opponents, falling mostly along party lines. A panel discussion this afternoon took a deep dive into the issue, and WORT reporter Elliot Hughes has more.
We're here to discuss some critical issues that are impacting Wisconsin voters and election officials. One of those issues that we want to discuss today, hopefully, is the upcoming April referendum to permanently enshrine photo ID into our state constitution.
Sam Liebert is a state director of All Voting is Local, a nonprofit that seeks to fight voting laws that disenfranchise marginalized groups. The group is opposed to state constitutional amendment that will be on your April 1st ballot. And today, All Voting is Local joined other voting rights organizations, along with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, for a panel on the upcoming referendum. Today's panel comes just over 2 weeks before Election Day, when Wisconsin voters will decide on a referendum that seeks to enshrine a voter ID requirement in the state's constitution. Wisconsin law already requires voters to present a valid form of photo ID before casting their ballots. The requirement became law in 2011, early in former Governor Scott Walker's term. The requirement was upheld in 2016 by a federal appeals court after a series of legal challenges. State Representative Lee Snodgrass is the ranking Democrat on the Assembly's Campaigns and Elections Committee. Speaking at today's panel, she explained why she plans to vote no on the constitutional amendment.
As you mentioned, it's existing state law. It's my feeling, and it's the feeling of most people, that you don't legislate via changing the Constitution. I think that there is pretty wide evidence that this is hitting the ballots for political reasons. I think that the majority party is afraid of what happens if we get into the majority, if we decide that existing law needs to be amended or changed or overturned entirely.
Representative Scott Krug, a Republican from Rome, chairs the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections. He also pointed to past legal challenges today when outlining why he plans to vote yes on the amendment.
But what this does is it gives both the parties into the future a chance to set photo ID to be whatever standard they want it to be legislatively, but also understanding that the requirement has to exist in the state constitution. I've been advocating that we have this put into our state constitution, let the legislators argue about the different details of it throughout the next few years or decades to figure out what the exception should be, what IDs we want to use. And that opens conversation for us to figure out exactly what the future of photo ID can be, whether it's digital, whether we have different implementation of different IDs. It leaves it open for us to have that discussion.
Anna Anderson, the voting rights coordinator of Disability Rights Wisconsin, says the proposal would add difficulty for disabled voters to cast ballots.
In the state of Wisconsin, over 25% of people that are voting age have a disability, but they vote at 11% less than people that do not have a disability. And if you just think about why would that be, there's a lot of reasons, but one of them that we've talked about today is not having the same access to getting your voter ID, accessibility at the actual location to get your ID, also the transportation to get there, and the assistance you might need to fill out the documentation.
And Dr. Shantae Nelson, co-director of All Voting is Local, adds that actually getting to the DMV is only half the battle.
Of the 80 permanent DMV service centers in Wisconsin, only 23 operated Monday through Friday and only 7 offered Saturday hours.
Constitutional amendments must be approved in 2 consecutive legislative sessions before going to the voters. If Wisconsin voters approve the referendum next month, that would make it much harder for future legislators to roll back the voter ID requirement. Constitutional amendments also allow state lawmakers to circumvent the governor's veto and bring their top issues directly to the voters, a tool state Republicans have used frequently since Democratic Governor Tony Evers took office in 2019. Republicans put 5 constitutional amendments before Wisconsin voters last year, the most in 1 year since 1982, reports the Associated Press. Representative Snodgrass said today that she's working on a bill to make the amendment process more transparent to voters.
It will require that constitutional amendments in Wisconsin be written in plain language. We will define what plain language means, and it will also say that if it is existing law, it must state that it is existing law. I think people want to know and understand what they're voting on.
In addition to the constitutional amendment, today's panelists also discussed a variety of changes they'd like to see to streamline elections in our state. That includes the Monday processing bill, automatic voter registration, and increased funding for city clerks' offices. Election day is, no joke, April 1st. In-person absentee voting starts tomorrow. For WORT News, I'm Elliot Hughes.
Campus union leaders are calling on the Board of Regents to discuss working conditions on UW campuses. Members of AFT Wisconsin demonstrated on Friday outside of Van Hise Hall. WORT reporter Shayna Clark was there.
Madeline Topf is a graduate student in microbiology at UW-Madison, where she's also a leader in the Graduate Worker Union, or TAA. She was in a building that houses departments in the humanities, trying to deliver a message to top UW system administrators.
So we're here in Van Hise Hall, and we're trying to find where the administrators work, and their work in floors that are locked to the public. So we're milling about here trying to give them letters from workers at the UW system, and we can't even figure out where they are or how we can get to the offices because it's confusing, and I think the places they do work are just completely locked up.
John Shelton is a faculty member at UW Green Bay. He's the new president of the Wisconsin Federation of Teachers.
We're trying to get a meeting with Regent President Amy Bogost. We've been asking for meetings for quite some time. We want to ask the Board of Regents to put a policy in place that ensures that our chancellors meet and confer, that they have good faith conversations about labor conditions with us.
So far, Shelton's emails haven't gotten a response from Bogost. The same goes for over 200 letters from workers across UW campuses. They decided to come in person.
We were trying to get access to the region president. We were trying to see if we could set up a meeting.
That also posed some hurdles.
Unfortunately, this is as far in the building as we can get.
Faculty, staff, and student workers are calling on the Board of Regents to put a meet and confer policy on an upcoming meeting agenda. Shelton says this policy is the bare minimum so that workers on campus can make their voices heard on a range of issues.
It is teaching load, it is workload, it is making sure that I have people hired to teach the classes that we need taught. That's something that we have been missing because of all of the budget cuts in the UW system.
Meet and confer, says Barrett Elward, president of United Faculty and Academic Staff, would also include student workers in all kinds of conversations about workplace concerns.
In our shared governance bodies at UW-Madison, we have separate bodies for academic staff, university staff, faculty, and students. So in those first three, the faculty and staff governance bodies, there are opportunities to talk about workplace conditions. In the Associated Students of Madison, which is the shared governance body for graduate students and undergraduate students, it's never on the agenda to talk about workplace issues, even though we have many student workers, and there's no venue for them to talk about workplace conditions and issues that they might be facing.
That includes wages, benefits, but other issues too.
There's a variety of issues from free speech on campus. I mean, we've seen some blatant violations of First Amendment rights in this new expressive activity policy that came out last year. Again, this was top down from administration, right? And this is designed to clamp down on protests or things that might hurt the university's brand.
The next Board of Regents meeting was scheduled to be in Madison on April 10th and 11th. That appears to be canceled in lieu of a virtual meeting a week later. For WORT News and Madison Labor Radio, I'm Shayna Clark, with thanks to Sarah Gabler.
It's now 6:18 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Incumbent Alder John Ugair is running for another term on the city council. He was unanimously elected by his peers in 2024 after the previous alder, Kristen Slack, resigned from office. Alder Ugair faces one opponent this spring in former alder Anthony Nino Amato, though Amato's eligibility remains up in the air as he has yet to move to his new residence within the district. Sitting down with WORT news producer Faye Parks, Alder Ugair outlined his commitment to community engagement.
Well, hello. I'm John Ugair, current alder for District 19 on Madison's west side. I was born and grew up in Wisconsin and got my undergraduate degree at UW-Madison, where I met Polly, my wife of 56 years. I spent most of my professional career leading businesses that built affordable housing, particularly energy-efficient housing, and I still consult with nonprofits on how to serve that market with current projects in Eugene, Oregon, and southwest Vermont. Polly and I have moved around and lived in many places, but Wisconsin has always been our home, and Madison always the place we wanted to end up.
Now, you served on the council since 2024, since last year. What is inspiring your run for another term?
Well, as I've already alluded to in my background, and I might add, that's affordable housing, sustainability, especially finance and budgeting expertise. And I think that aligns almost perfectly with Madison's current challenges in the area of housing, the structural deficit, sustainability, and other things that I think I can apply my expertise to. I found that to be the case during this first year in my term, and I would like to continue that for another term.
What is one specific achievement that you drove forward in your latest term on the council?
I would have to say that the effort this past year on communicating the facts and challenges of Madison's structural deficit. For those who might not remember it, I put together three sessions, two in person in the district and one virtual, in which I not only dove deep into the numbers that we were facing in our budget choices, but also invited some of the experts from staff to talk about areas that I knew were particularly sensitive. So I'm glad I did that. I learned so much in the process.
Housing is perhaps the most complex and sprawling issue the city faces. It impacts everyone, from families trying to find an affordable home to college students trying to find affordable off-campus housing. A recent city report found that the income needed to pay Madison's median monthly rent without becoming housing cost burdened correlates to a full-time job, paying about $28 per hour or $58,000 a year. This issue is so complicated, it's hard to know where to start. What do you believe is an achievable jumping-off point to address Madison's affordable housing crisis?
First of all, the point we have to get across in any of our messaging is that this is a basic problem of supply and demand. We have not produced housing as fast as the city has grown, and that's created the pressure on prices, and the pressure on prices has created increase in assessed value. That's driven people to even higher property taxes or rents. What we're really focusing on now in those areas that I'm involved in, where we're really pushing to accelerate housing, is let's look at how we're redeveloping or filling in undeveloped spaces along the major corridors that have good public transit. And at least in District 19, that especially means along the new BRT corridor along Mineral Point. That, in fact, is where developers are really looking at the opportunities that the city is putting before them, whether it's how the zoning is set or incentives that we can provide to have some of those be affordable units. So I think we really need to drive along and take advantage of what we've already accomplished.
Madison voters faced an unusual choice in November and ultimately decided to say yes to a city funding referendum on the ballot that raised property taxes. Still, city finance leaders say the city's structural budget deficit is a chronic issue worsening over time. What is one way you would lead the city to address the budget deficit outside of raising property taxes again?
Out of that referendum, we did the very first ever long-range plan, a five-year plan, for what we're going to do for the next period of years. And really at its heart, that plan is a way to give us breathing room, to let us sustain the services that a growing Madison needs while we redouble our efforts to get a fair deal from the state. The first is there's a commitment that's in that adopted five-year plan, and that is during that period of time, we're pledging not to have another referendum. You know, the next thing we have to do is we really have to fine-tune that effort to balance how we're going to keep providing those services, and that's going to include a balance in between efficiencies, which we're going to find out how to get. I'm going to have my name on some more things about that, where we can get some further efficiencies in the city, and some judicious changes in fees, maybe some new fees, and then a very careful drawdown in our very ample rainy day fund. Fortunately, we have some room to draw that down. And then the final thing that I want to participate in is that the entire council, the mayor's office, needs to work on this coalition that we've started to form with other mayors of Dane County, and I've talked to a few of them, as well as mayors around the whole state that are now also seeing that they are really being injured by the current arrangements for revenue sharing at the state level. With the new balance in the state legislature, I think we can achieve a bipartisan approach to reforming that revenue sharing program. It's not going to probably happen in this biennium. That's why we needed time to work on it. But for the longer run, we need to achieve that opportunity to get a better and a fairer plan. And that's what I'm going to work on.
I want to ask how you think about your role on the council. Alders have two priorities to their constituents and their districts and to the city of Madison. Sometimes those priorities conflict. How would you handle an issue that drives forward the city's goals but is unpopular among your constituents?
The vast majority of things that come before us have a perfect alignment of the interests of the people in the district and the city as a whole. It's only those few that really erupt in a lot of very notable controversies. I think for me, one of the most interesting things to face and to work through is what happens if you've got two different neighborhoods within the district that have different agendas and are supporting different things, and how do you work through that? And part of it, I think, is you just got to share a lot of information. You might change a few minds. Maybe you're not going to in the end. You know, but in District 19, we've got these very large areas of detached single-family homes with a certain concern about the value of their property and the nature of their neighborhood. And then we have these big neighborhoods of lots of apartment buildings and renters who have a different view on this thing. And as I hear from the renters, some of them are irate about the pushback on more housing and so forth that would help with their rents if we had more housing and less pressure on rents. So it's just an interesting problem. There's always going to be a situation where people's self-interest is not the same, and we're human, they're going to act according to their self-interest. And the best thing I think we can do is show some respect for those different opinions, share as much information as you can, and at the end of the day, vote our values as we see them for the benefit of the whole city.
Incumbent Alder John Uguerre will be on the April 1st ballot. He faces one challenger in Nino Amato, former board president of the Wisconsin Technical College System. You can learn more about Alder Uguerre's re-election campaign on his website, johnformadison.vote. That's john4madison.vote.
You are listening to handcrafted local news here on WORT. Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. We'll share the local government's calendar for the week ahead. We'll celebrate St. Paddy's Day with a story of international solidarity. We'll taste test a few more shots, and we'll review two features.
But now we'll take a quick break, and then we'll check in on some world headlines. Back in a flash. WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, March 19th at 6 p.m. in person at the station at 118 South Bedford Street. The public is welcome to attend. This meeting is also available virtually via Zoom. For information on how to attend this meeting virtually, please email president@wortfm.org. YWCA Madison invites you to join them to celebrate the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. YWCA Madison is eager to gather with their community of supporters to share stories that speak to who they are and demonstrate their values of humanity, community, growth, and restoration, which are at the heart of how they move as an organization. Attending the Circle fundraiser impacts the lives of thousands of women, children, and families who are served each year through YWCA's transformational programs in housing and shelter, employment and transportation, restorative justice, and learning and movement building. More information about the Circle fundraiser and other YWCA programs and resources can be found at ywcamadison.org. That's the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center. Keeping you informed of community events and resources, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
News with Fiona MacDonald. Canada's new Prime Minister Mark Carney has said his country must reduce its reliance on the United States and would instead turn towards what he described as its reliable European allies. Mr. Carney made his first official trip abroad to France and the UK instead of the US, as would usually be the case. President Trump has slapped trade tariffs on Canadian goods and says he wants it to be America's 51st state. M23 rebels have withdrawn from peace talks with the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo in Angola on Tuesday. The group accused unspecified international institutions of undermining the peace efforts. Peru's government has introduced a 30-day state of emergency in the capital, Lima, following a recent wave of violence, including the murder of a popular singer. President Dina Boluarte said she was considering reintroducing the death penalty as a deterrent. The European Union and its partners have pledged $6.2 billion in aid to Syria following the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad last year. It announced the sum at a donor conference. The British Foreign Secretary David Lammy has for the first time stated that Israel has breached international law by stopping humanitarian aid from entering Gaza since the beginning of March. Mr. Lammy said Israel must defend its own security, but he said it had been 15 days since aid got into Gaza, and the UK government found that alarming. Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun has warned that his country will respond to cross-border fire from Syria that has killed at least seven people. Clashes broke out on Sunday after Syria's interim government accused Lebanon's Hezbollah of murdering three of its soldiers. And President Trump says his administration will this week make public around 80,000 pages of files related to the assassination in 1963 of President John F. Kennedy. BBC News.
The current time right now is 6:33 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news right here on WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz, here with my co-host, Rachel Fields. We're glad you're with us.
This week on Forward Lookout, host Rebecca Kemble and producer Christina Liffring run through some upcoming meetings, including some public art planning, the city selling public park land, and the county granting its corporate counsel broad authorization to initiate or enter a lawsuit.
Welcome to Forward Lookout for the week of March 17th, 2025. I'm Christina Leffring, and I'm here with Rebecca Kemble. Hi, Rebecca.
Hey, Christina. We're Brenda free today.
We are. Brenda Conkle of ForwardLookout.com is out this week, so we'll just have to muddle through, won't we?
I think it's cool how we have three of us in Constellation, and any two of us are okay in here on Mondays.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
All right. Well, let's start with Dane County. Today at 1 p.m., the EV Advisory Commission met.
Yes, this apparently is a new commission of the Dane County Board, and this is about a program they call Charge Up Dane County that looks for gaps in the electric vehicle charging infrastructure and figures out what to do about it.
All right. Well, then moving on to Tuesday, March 18th, 9:30 a.m., the Commission on Sensitive Crimes. I'm not familiar with this commission.
Me neither. And later on at the Dane County Board meeting on Thursday, they are populating all of their committees, commissions, and boards with resident members. So I think they're just getting some legislative updates, their agency updates. It'll be interesting to see what their actual agenda is, what work they're going to be doing in the community.
Moving on to Wednesday, March 19th at 5:30 p.m., we have the Health and Human Needs Committee meeting.
They're going to be approving a couple of affordable housing projects, one on Odana Road, one on Commercial Avenue. Those are both in the city of Madison. And the Community Action Coalition's Mental Health and Trauma Recovery Program update. They'll also be talking about the city of Madison men's shelter.
So then we're moving on to Thursday, March 20th, 5:30 p.m., the Executive Committee is meeting.
They have three items on their agenda. One is those county executive appointments, which are were those committee and commission appointments I talked about earlier, urging the Governor Evers and Wisconsin legislature to support the county courts. And also, they will be voting on a proposed resolution to basically give the Dane County Corporate Council, which is the in-house legal team of the county, blanket authorization from the board to join or initiate lawsuits that are in interests of Dane County government and Dane County residents. Now, that seems like a pretty big blanket authorization on the one hand. On the other hand, like, they're literally, their job is to protect the interests of Dane County government and Dane County residents. So the preamble to the resolution talks about Trump and all the executive orders. But the actual resolution says blanket authority, go ahead and initiate or join any lawsuit you want as long as you think it's in the interest of the Dane County government or Dane County residents.
All right. Well, 7 p.m., the county board is meeting.
Yep. And they will be voting on those three items that the executive committee was taking up, appointing Lacey Fox as a Dane County legislative lobbyist and authorizing agreements for funding that have already passed Dane County committees before.
Moving on to the city, starting on today, March 17th at noon, the Madison Arts Commission Public Art Standing Committee met.
Yes, they did. They reviewed applications for the Monona Terrace Art on the Rooftop. They got a public market art plan update and the city-county building art plan. They were looking at some recommendations around that.
And 4:30 p.m., the Finance Committee met.
Yep, they were talking about purchase of service agreements. They're selling 776 square feet from Spring Harbor Beach Park, selling that to an adjacent neighbor. They'll be looking at authorizing $75,000 grant from the state to support creating equitable outcomes for homeless and other marginalized adults in training and vocational support services. That appears to be being passed on to Just Dane for their Just Bakery program. They're also authorizing Cafe Coda for exclusive alcohol beverages services at Warner Park Community Rec Center. And also at the very end, they will be getting a report from the police department about who donated to them in 2024.
All right. Well, then 5:30 p.m., the Plan Commission met.
Yes, they talked about demolishing a three-family residence in District 8 at 210 Bernard Court. They're also talking about a conditional use permit for the former Red Shed at 406 North Francis Street so that it can become a nightclub. And they also are talking about the Great Midwest Bank at 6702 Odana Road, both a demolition permit and conditional use to build a four-story mixed-use building with 60 apartments and first-floor commercial space.
Okay, so then moving on to Tuesday, at 5:30 p.m., the Madison Arts Commission will be meeting again.
Yep, they're going to talk about the 2025-2026 annual grants. They're going to vote on those. Unfortunately, the Legistar link goes to a document that has comments on legacy grants, not the actual list of proposed projects. So maybe they'll hear this and put the right link in. They're also going to talk about that Monona Terrace art on the rooftop and just administrative updates.
Moving on to Wednesday, March 19th at 3 p.m., the Parks Long Range Planning Subcommittee is meeting.
Yeah, they're talking about the Parks and Open Space Plan update, which has been going on for over a year. There are like 61 attachments to this Legistar item. So it's been a long-term, intense process. And if you're interested in knowing where they're at in the process, show up at 3 p.m. virtually.
And then 5 p.m., the Transportation Commission is meeting.
Yeah, they're talking about a couple things, particularly in District 14, that's on the south side, the Perry Street overpass. In District 12, they're going to be talking about the North Stoughton Road project regarding Schmiedeman Avenue, and then the annual traffic signal priority list.
And then Thursday, March 20th at 10 a.m., the Equal Opportunities Commission is holding a hearing.
Yes, that's usually a subcommittee of the EOC together with an administrative judge to hear a complaint. This one is Asia Masent versus Foot Locker, so that's an employment complaint.
And finally, on Friday, March 21st at 6 p.m., there's a notice of a possible quorum of the Police Civilian Oversight Board.
Yes, the PCOB and the Office of the Independent Monitor is hosting a community listening session. It will be at Just Dane and also virtual. It will be held in person at 128 East Olin Avenue, Suite 22. That's kind of by the Alliant Energy Center right across Olin Avenue from that. And it's open to members of the public. It's there for people to come in and talk about their experience with the Madison Police Department. This is something new that they're doing, and they're going around to different organizations that nominate members of the Police Civilian Oversight Board. To those nominating organizations, they'll be holding listening sessions around the city.
All right. Well, we got through it.
We did.
That's the week ahead in local government. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Christina. We miss you, Brenda.
Hopefully Brenda will be feeling better next week. For more news about the week ahead, go to forwardlookout.com. There you can find a roundup of local news articles every day and the link to ask Brenda and Rebecca a question and have them answer it on air. No questions this week.
So far, no takers.
All right. For more information, check out the extended version on the WORT website. And we'll be back next week with more updates on the city and Dane County. Keep watching.
Well, if you haven't heard or couldn't tell by the sea of green, today is St. Patrick's Day, a good day to remember the world's most dangerous grocery store workers in Dublin. Thanks to their efforts in 1984, Ireland became the first Western nation to ban apartheid goods from South of Africa. Feature contributor Harry Richardson brings us the story.
I can't check out your oranges, Mrs. Now, won't you bring them back? For they come from South Africa, where white oppresses black. I'd have it on my conscience, and I couldn't sleep at night if I had to support the system that denies black people's rights.
Today, March 17th, is St. Patrick's Day, a good day to remember the accidental South African solidarity movement started by young Irish grocery workers in 1984 that would make Ireland the first Western nation to ban apartheid goods from South Africa. The Dunn's Store strike began on July 19th, 1984, in Dublin. Mary Manning, a 21-year-old checker, refused to ring up two grapefruits following her union's decision to boycott apartheid South African goods. Manning was sent up to the manager's office, but refused to change her mind. When she was suspended, nine of her colleagues walked out with her and formed a picket line. They were all between the ages of 17 and 28. The confrontation had been brewing for months. "We were following a union instruction because we had been treated so badly," Karen Giron, one of the strikers, said. Giron was shop steward for the Irish Distributive and Administrative Trade Union, IDATU, and Mary Manning's best friend. "If we had been working in a nice environment, would we have taken that union instruction seriously? I don't know. Probably not." The union workers, mostly women, had many grievances against Dunn's, mostly male managers. They were only allowed two toilet breaks per day of 8 minutes each, despite the toilet being 8 floors up. Managers searched their bags when they left the shop and embarrassed them if pads or tampons were found. There were allegations of sexual sexual harassment. Guerin recalls seeing young girls crying because the management have intimidated and upset them. Mary Manning admitted that she couldn't spell apartheid when she was first suspended. But less than a week into the strike, a South African refugee showed up on the picket line. Nimrod Sanjay had been a South African activist tried for treason alongside Nelson Mandela and forced into exile. He was living in a Red Cross hostel 4 miles from Manning's store. Sanjay began attending the pickets every day, describing the realities of apartheid, the denial of civil liberties to the black majority, the enforced destitution, the exploitation, and the killing. He compared apartheid to a glass of Guinness beer with a white layer on top of the black. He talked of his family, including 3 children he had not seen for 20 years. An early picket line supporter was the Irish Anti-Apartheid Movement, IAAM founder, ANC member Kadar Ashmal. Other organizations also provide support, including Labour Youth, Sinn Féin, Action from Ireland, and the Dockers Union. Public opinion was mixed. More disappointing was the minimal support by their own union. The local bishop, Eamon Casey, privately disapproved of the strike, and some priests even encouraged parishioners to cross the picket line. Worst of all, by October 1984, Ashmal withdrew his support, saying the strike had gone on long enough. The workers also faced horrible treatment from the police. The first breakthrough came in August 1984, when Archbishop Desmond Tutu requested a meeting with the strikers en route to collect his Nobel Peace Prize. Within 2 minutes, this hugely powerful and influential man had given us more validation than anybody in Ireland since the beginning of our action, wrote Manning. And the next year, Tutu invited them to see apartheid firsthand. Although the strikers got no funds from their union or the anti-apartheid organization, they raised £7,000 in one night of bucket shaking at Dublin pubs. Support for the strikers was growing. At the airport, the strikers' visa-free access was revoked, but they were ushered onto a plane anyway, then held by the police in Johannesburg. 8 terrifying hours later, the group was flown back to Heathrow, but not before Guerin declared from the steps of the plane, "We will be back when South Africa is free." Later, she said, "Going through my head was, they are a bunch of bastards." Stoked by the uncertainty over their disappearance, reporters had assembled at Dublin's airport. IDATU union organizer Archibald had declared he was in the presence of the 8 most dangerous supermarket workers in the world. But by December 1985, the union ordered the strikers to halt their picket while the government investigation began. By February, the government confirmed prison labor on South African farms, meaning the union boycott was legal by the GATT trade treaty. The strikers had won. By April 1987, not one product from South Africa was on the shelf of an Irish shop, and the strike officially ended. The strikers were finally honored at a 1990 Dublin meeting of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions and the IAAM, and a now free Nelson Mandela had asked to meet the grocery workers, recognizing their sacrifice for the South African people. After Mandela died in 2013, the Irish people demanded that the strikers walk ahead of Irish dignitaries at Mandela's funeral. It was an experience that none of us could ever have imagined, Guerin said. The best part was meeting Sejeke's family. Sejeke had returned to a free South Africa to serve as secretary of the Soweto ANC Veterans League before passing away in 2004. And that is our Irish working class story for today. For The Past in the Past, I'm Harry Richardson.
It's now 6:47 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
This week on Madison Mixology, feature contributor Charlie Bielowski and fellow bartender Riley Capel treat us to pancakes and syrup in the form of the breakfast shot. They'll give us some insight into the shot's amazing tastes and smells and then the ingredients used to make it.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to another installment of Madison Mixology. I'm your host and favorite segmentist, Charlie Bielowski. Today, I have for you part three of the ongoing shot special with my co-host and fellow bartender, Riley Capel. Speaking of, though, we're going to actually segue in. The orange juice from the lunchbox is also in the next drink we're going to be drinking, which is pancakes and syrup.
Keeping the breakfast theme going.
Exactly. That's another reason that we're going to be continuing this. And we just had these shots made for us. And I got to say, smelling that is just...
It smells like maple syrup.
It smells like maple syrup. And that's the funny thing. Like, where is that coming from? The butterscotch, I guess?
Yeah, the butterscotch and orange juice together. I guess they kind of just make that smell.
Now, the pancakes and syrup, I believe the three ingredients in this was what was in an ounce of JMO, it was an ounce of orange juice, and an ounce of butterscotch schnapps.
Yep.
I suppose that really kind of like sugary, syrupy taste would probably be coming from the butterscotch out of everything else.
Definitely.
Yeah. So what I was able to find with the pancake shot that we originally had is that it goes by a more common name of the breakfast shot. And I suppose that makes sense because it definitely smells like breakfast. I can definitely smell a lot of that syrupiness in there. And then you said it has what, bacon leaves in the official recipe?
Well, when it's served in higher end places, a lot of times they'll use little strips of bacon
almost
as the garnish for it.
Almost like a wedge of lemon, but instead of the wedge of lemon, it's like a wedge of bacon.
Exactly.
That actually sounds pretty nice.
I would agree.
You can really smell like almost, it smells like a morning breakfast, and that's just, it's crazy to think about.
It smells like pancakes and waffles.
Well, I think we shouldn't waste any more time with this. I definitely want to try this. What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right, down the hatch. I'll be honest, I think it's a little bit heavy on the whiskey.
I would agree.
That one, you can definitely taste a lot of it, especially going down the throat. You know how every once in a while you get that kind of like blast of alcohol that goes back up your nose when you drink something harder?
Yep.
That's kind of what I had with this, to be completely honest. I think we went a little bit heavy on the JMO, but I will say, letting that kind of like marinate in my mouth a bit and kind of like the aftertaste that comes with it, it definitely does leave that pancakes and syrup type of taste within your mouth. And I can definitely see how this would benefit from a bacon leaf included with it.
I 100% agree. I mean, going down the hatch, it didn't really taste like pancakes or waffles, but definitely that after flavor definitely leaves like you just had breakfast.
It tastes and like buttery waffles or buttery pancakes.
And I think a piece of bacon would be the perfect chaser for it.
Honestly, I think it would do well to mute a lot of that alcohol that kind of goes down with it, that alcohol-y type of kind of aftertaste that you get within that. That mm-hmm. would definitely benefit from something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I can definitely see why it would be considered a breakfast staple, especially with just everything that's included in this. It's incredibly pleasing on the palate, but a little bit more harder than a lot of the other stuff that we've drank.
The other things we had, I would say went down a lot easier, but it does leave a pleasant aftertaste in your mouth. It's just the act of going down your throat isn't necessarily the most optimal taste.
Exactly. I agree. I prefer something, I think we both said this before, we both prefer something a little bit more smooth than this, a little bit less alcoholic tasting.
I'm not known to sip my whiskey neat.
I agree 100%. That's all for this week. Tune in next week for another installment of Madison Mixology. I'm Charlie Bielowski.
Today, feature contributor Harry Richardson reviews a new-ish documentary and a cult classic from 1999. The Union tells the story of the Staten Island Amazon workers who led an organizing campaign in 2022, and Office Space is a revenge fantasy about, you guessed it, office workers. Don't mess with the nerds.
Is Chris Smalls. He was fired when he went outside and protested.
You make Amazon $638 million a day. It's time we get paid off this shit.
And that was clip from the trailer for The Union, a great cinema verite documentary on the only successful organizing drive so far at an Amazon warehouse, the JFK 8 warehouse in Staten Island, New York. It was the final movie in the UW Haven Center Social Justice Center film series. The warehouses are euphemistically called fulfillment centers. The directors, producers, Brett Story and Stephen Ming, covered the story from its beginnings in early 2021 to the union vote in 2022. Ming and Martin Disigo are the cinematographers. Some of the footage also came from rank-and-file workers. We see the organizing drive, warts and all, Our central character is the charismatic founder of the Amazon Labor Union, Christian Smalls. We meet Smalls in the opening scene, serving burgers and hot dogs from a grill to Amazon workers. He was fired in 2020 after planning and attending a walkout over pandemic safety conditions. This is important context for the story. The workers started organizing during the pandemic when they were recognized as essential workers, shipping out personal protective equipment, PPE, without being given any by the company. There were other reasons for organizing: the brutal pace of work, the low pay, and minimal benefits. The documentary shows the uphill battle to organize over 3,500 workers with an annual turnover rate of 150%. The film shows the hardships endured by the core organizers outside in all sorts of weather, enduring long hours talking to potential union members, and the group's inevitable tensions and disagreements. Some of the most moving scenes showed the lives of ordinary workers and what they endured each day. One scene of a woman sleeping in her car in winter in a barren parking lot was particularly infuriating. People working hard all day under incredible stress and still not making enough to have a decent roof over their heads. Tragically, this is the only Amazon warehouse organized so far. Affiliation with the Teamsters has not been enough to build successful campaigns elsewhere in the U.S., despite the organizing of between 8 and 10,000 workers. The workers at 8 warehouses led a limited strike last year from December 19th to Christmas Eve. The workers at the JFK 8 warehouse have yet to gain a contract. Quebec has more favorable labor laws, like a card check that allows unions to be recognized after 50% of workers sign on. The province also requires first contract arbitration. If bargaining reaches an impasse, either party has the right to request that a contract be drafted and imposed by an arbitrator. The Amazon workers organized all 7 warehouses across the province by mid-February of this year, but Amazon announced the closure of all its warehouses rather than recognize a union. The company will outsource its warehouse operations and the jobs of their drivers to an outside third party, leaving 4,500 workers jobless. Reformers and labor activists have urged Quebec to pass a law declaring Amazon a joint employer in its contracts with third parties, but that would likely take years. In the meantime, a boycott Amazon campaign is gaining support across the province. Up next, a classic office job revenge fantasy.
Well, it looks like you've been missing quite a bit of work lately.
Well, I wouldn't say I've been missing it, Bob.
That's just a straight shooter with upper management written all over.
That was a clip from the 1999 cult classic Office Space, directed by Mike Judge. This is a great laugh-out-loud movie. You don't have to have worked in an office to appreciate it, but it would help. Our central character is everyman, Peter Gibbons. Ron Livingston, who hates his dull job. He's joined in his frustrations by 2 co-workers, Michael Bolton, David Herman, and Samir Ajay Naida. Peter is in a constant state of anxiety over his job and having problems with his girlfriend. To please her, he goes to a hypnotherapist with her. But as Peter is going under, the hypnotherapist has a heart attack. Suddenly, Peter's anxiety is gone, and he does nothing the next day, Saturday, ignoring his boss's calls. Gary Cole is perfect as Peter's smug boss, Lumberg. Initially, we think Peter is still hypnotized, but Peter says he doesn't know what has happened to him. But when he saw the hypnotherapist fall over, he realized life is short and we have no time to waste, especially in cubicles. He returns to work with a new attitude: I don't give a bleep. This amusingly gets him promoted when 2 efficiency experts decide he is management material. Meanwhile, his 2 friends are among those being fired, and the 3 plot revenge. There's a nice supporting role here for Jennifer Aniston as Joanna, Peter's new girlfriend. A very fun movie, especially the final third. I highly recommend it. It's on several streaming services. I saw it on Hulu. For WRT's Monday Movie Review, I'm Harry Richardson.
And that does it for our show. Thanks so much for tuning in to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your headline writer this evening was Nate Carlin. Elliot Hughes and Shayna Clark were your reporters. Special thanks to our feature contributors, Harry Richardson, Christina Leffering, Rebecca Kemble, and Charlie Belosky. Thanks also to Nicholas Leet for technical production. Victor Calzoni engineered this show, Faye Parks produced this newscast, and Shally Pittman is the news director here at WORT. I'm your host, Sam Swartz.
And I'm your host, Rachel Fields. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you listen. Up next is the most freeform show on your radio dial. It's called The Access Hour. Have a great night.
are listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
Support for this program comes from Greater Madison Music City. Through proven strategies, success stories, and challenges, the Music City Circuit, presented by Greater Madison Music City, will highlight music tourism's role as a driver of urban transformation, offering valuable insights on how to shape our future as a music city while empowering our local musicians and music-related businesses. The Music City Circuit, coming soon to select streaming platforms. More information at ourgmmc.org.
Welcome to the Access Hour, where each week WORT offers you the opportunity to fly your program over the radio. The Access Hour is WORT's commitment to community access to the airwaves. For this hour, we have turned the airwaves over to a member of the public. The views expressed on the Access Hour do not represent the views of the station, its staff, programmers, or the board of directors. We'd like this show to be as unpredictable as possible, so we need your creative ideas. It's a fair trade. You give us what you've got, and we give you the facilities and any help you need to get your program airborne. So let your mind wander and wonder. And when the inspiration for some pretty good radio glows with a clear, bright light, get in touch. Just go to WORTFM.org and look on the left side for Sign Up to Host an Access Hour. Programs are scheduled first come, first served. And now it's time to begin another foray into the freest form program on the WORT schedule, the Access Hour.
Support for this program.
Hello, folks. This is John Peck with Family Farm Defenders. I also happen to be a local farmer with Yellow Dog Flowers and Produce with my partner, Molly Stentz, who used to be a